This is Father Drino. This is Father Drino. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats, whether you are with the esteemed cohort that is with us live, or if you're catching us here on the podcast. If you are with us live, today is that classic Midrats melee, which means open topic, open phones, open chat room. We might have an open mind. We don't know. We depends on what subject you bring up. But if you'd like to, scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. Our good friend Paul is there standing athwart the quarter deck. He'll welcome you aboard. We'll watch that during the course of the show as we chat things up. If you've got a topic you'd like for us to talk about, or if you wanted to push back on the topic we were presently talking about, that's a great place to do it. And occasionally somebody gets over-caffeinated and wants to give us a call. The phone number is right there on the show page. It's 347-308-8397 if you wanted to call. Hey, I see the right Cal and also the other Sal have also joined us in the chat room. So, hey, Eagle One, it's not just going to be you and me today chatting it up. Good afternoon to you.
Hey, how are you?
Better than I deserve. I made myself some nice white tea yesterday and left it in the teapot, but that's okay. Just to upset my British friends, I microwaved it to heat it up, and so I've got my nice warm tea to start our melee for the day, and I figured that's kind of appropriate because I thought we'd talk with which I thought was from the you can't get training like this, you can't pay for training like that type of exercise that the British HMS Defender, did I get that right? They had a great experience this week that I think we all were a little jealous of, is they were doing a transit between Ukraine and Georgia, not the U.S. state, but the nation of Georgia, the other side of the Black Sea. And they decided they wanted to do a little bit of a passing review through what they consider Ukrainian territorial waters, and got a free air show from the Russians. I thought that was a good show this week.
Yeah, you know, nothing as it says excitement like having a flyby by the Russian Air Force / Navy ship airplane. So something we miss from the old days of the Cold War.
It is. I'll say it with the appropriate voice here. When you talk to the little young pups, we tell them about... We used to see stuff like that all the time. It was not rare or common, but it was, you know, the Russians came out and threw a shoulder now and then. Occasionally you had a drunk skipper of a submarine that echoed too in the Mediterranean in the 70s, which kind of rammed one of our frigates. It was also fun too, but it was a pretty exciting thing for the British because the Royal Navy's been stretching their arms and legs a little bit. But this morning, when I checked my news, I got a little bit of humor there because I think it's kind of, we'll call this a Midrats public service announcement. One for those with security clearances and also for the general public. For those who have security clearances, do not take your work home with you. We all know who couriers are and what they're supposed to do. And for the general public, if in your local neighborhood bus stop, you find, what is the exact quote here from the article in the BBC? P- Papers came to be lying on a street corner in the rain in the early hours Tuesday morning. There was a big stack of classified documents found at a bus stop in Kent in England that were related to this exact event. And the civilian who found them, I guess technically it's a government organization, but just turned it over to the press. It's interesting. It comes from their permanent joint headquarters. The classification was UK eyes only. Well, yeah, I guess all the United Kingdom and a few other ones are going to see it. But it's interesting, if people haven't already, it's over in the BBC, it's Operation Diderite, Diderite, which, Eagle One, I think you Googled earlier and told me is some type of volcanic rock, which is kind of funny. What's interesting about it is it talks about the options they had, about they could either avoid tickling the Russian ribs, but if they do that, they in a way will be acknowledging the fact that Crimea is Russian, or they could do as if they considered it still Ukrainian national waters. And they saw the Russian responses could be from safe and professional to neither safe nor professional. I think we are somewhere in between the two. So you are really good at this. So if you could, we'll have you put on your legal advisor hat here for a second for the British. What point were they making by going through that passage, vice going out to the middle of the Black Sea and not bothering anybody?
Well, the Convention on the Law of the Sea says you can transit a foreign ship, even a warship, can transit another nation's waters as long as the passage is not prejudicial to the peace, good order, security of the coastal state. And the fun part about this particular instance is that the coastal state, for most of the world, is Crimea belongs to Ukraine, not Russia, which a lot of people view as illegally occupying Crimea. So Russian excitement about this is just, it kind of reminds me of the Chinese arguing about the islands, the artificial islands they've created in the South China Sea, about the passage of U.S. warships close to them. That, you know, under the Convention of the Law of the Sea, which I think both China and Russia have signed on to, that's not illegal, and Russia's excitement is totally out of whack. Now, you know, that we got to tie this to what Russia's up to, though. I mean, I think Hal Sutton at U.S. Navy News, Naval Institute News, pointed out that Russia's been spoofing the AIS, the system that allows us to identify where ships are. So in the instance that Sutton pointed out was that the ships were actually in port, but the Russians had them passing dangerously close to Crimea, you know, which kind of points that maybe they had this document before. Who knows, maybe a Russian courier dropped this thing in the rain and exposed it that way. But kind of interesting, the Russians had the track all laid out well ahead of time. So it's just kind of fun from our point of view, I think.
And we're talking about the old Cold War. One of the funniest comments I heard about this was that somewhere in England there's a GRU agent who was nervously going from bus stop to bus stop looking for his cold drop that he was supposed to pick up. It sounds funny, but knowing how the Soviets and now the Russians have so effectively, historically, penetrated British military and British intelligence, that wouldn't be a shock. But some tells me that was just somebody taking work home for some reason. And you know, there have been multiple stories for people who have done that. Don't do it. Not a paper copy, not a thumb drive. That's just so stupid. Luckily, it was something relatively benign like that. But we've all heard or seen people who they become so senior, they forget that they're mortals, and they think they're so important that nothing bad or accidental will happen to them, forgetting that they are other people, having other people. But you can really, and military history is full of examples. For instance, was it the plans, the Confederate plans for Antietam or Gettysburg, one of the two, were found wrapped around some cigars that fell out of somebody's coat. And of course, there have been examples of people spoofing that too. Don't do it. Don't give anybody a free mulligan. But don't turn it into the press. Be a good citizen and call your local military base and say, do you want your, you know, top secret TSSCI with a bunch of little numbers and letters next to it? Yeah, you probably should turn that into the front gate.
Yeah, and I think the other aspect of this is, I think the article that BBC put out notes that there were journalists on board the HMS Defender to provide independent verification of Defender's actions. So, you know, this I don't know how this thing got there. I'm always suspicious when things show up at bus stops, the very reason that you point out, that it sounds more like a drop than a than somebody accidentally leap, you know, having it fall out of their backpack while they're waiting for a bus. I mean, I know that a lot of people in Britain don't use private cars, but it seems to me that the circumstance about this, although they're kind of funny to us, do require some I'm sure the Brits are looking into it pretty closely about how this thing comes out. And I don't know how the Brits handle their secret material, but I know we had to pretty much account for it all on a pretty rigid basis. And most of the things were numbered copies, so you could pretty much identify who it belonged to if necessary. So,
yeah, you know, especially part of it was a printout, and again, I don't know how the British run their system, but if it's something similar to my classified NATO system, anytime you go Control P, that's logged. So I'm sure somebody has gone through PJHQ, which I believe is still up in Northwood, and said, show me all the PowerPoint presentation told with this subject line have been printed. And they figure out who this, I would assume they figured out who this is. And they're in a fair bit of trouble, as they should be. Fear and shame are great motivators.
Yeah, should be. But, you know, apparently, and I think it's important that the Western countries continue to do this freedom of navigation operations, or actually sailing in this case through a potential ally's waters, kind of like the U.S. Navy ships sailing through the Strait of Taiwan. Those are not internal waters of China. And even if they were, if you're doing innocent passage, then you're just doing innocent passage. And we just have to keep doing that. We cannot bow down to these thuggish behaviors of Russia and China in this case.
And I'm sure there's a fancy legal term for it somewhere, but both internationally and domestically in most countries, there is, if you want to talk about properties and things like that, you know, easements are commonly used or traditionally used paths, transportations. I think in England, you have a right to cross private property if it's on in a, some of these trails date back a couple thousand years and you can't fence those off. Or out west, you can't fence off access to trout streams, which upsets a few people who think they own part of a trout stream and they don't, and people fish it. But if you don't do that, over time, that right to public access disappears, because nobody's used it and nobody's done it for a very, very long time. So you're right. I think that's great that the British did that. I wish that other navies besides the UK and the US would do that. Otherwise, it's just those nasty Anglo-Saxons doing things on the high seas. Because the Russian cannot be allowed to get away with that. It's just a really bad precedent. It tells the Chinese and other bullies on the international scene what they can or can't do. I remember, you know, back in the day, you know, a lot of people say, well, we'll just cruise around the Gulf of Mexico. Great, come on. We'd love the training. If you're going to transit the Florida Straits, everybody's going to love, you know, flying on a non-cooperative target. So, yeah, come on. Come out to play. We don't care. But they do care over there, and we can't let them start to mark off square footage.
Well, it's a challenge again to the what has been the rules, literally the rules of the road, established by, you know, long precedent, and you know, the countries that are trying to challenge those traditional rules are Russia and China, and they have, you know, they believe they have good reasons to do so. China says, oh, we were a weak country under control of you bad people back in those days, so we didn't have the right to participate and make these international rules, so we don't have to abide by them. You know, and they're really good at presenting once they start doing something, unless you smack them down, you know, then everything becomes, this is the way it's been. And look, we set these islands up and it's too late to do anything about it. And what are you going to do? Go to war over a piece of rock that we've turned into a military run, right? You know, so, you know, and it's followed up by, there's a threat that China has made that they, unless the U.S. severs all military ties with Taiwan, we could face war. I mean, that's, I don't know if you saw that, but some spokesman for China's defense ministry issued a warning to, this is from MSN News, but I think it's reported by somebody else, Daily Express. This guy said, you know, he's got to sever all military ties with Taiwan. It's the complete reunification of China's historical necessity, and the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation is an unstoppable trend, blah, blah, blah. You know, so
blah, blah, blah.
Taiwan independence is a dead-end road, and seeking it means war. That's strong language, and you can't, you know, you just have to push back against that, and they need a strong pushback, not just a verbal, oh, that's not right, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that should just play into our hand of the fact to reestablishing those types of connections to Taiwan that we had before Kissinger and Nixon rolled the dice on China, which turned out to be a bad bet in the long run. But I think it would also be helpful if the Taiwanese would up their military spending a little bit. They don't quite spend as much as you would think. As a percent of their GDP, they're a large, relatively rich, modern country. If they just increase their spending a little bit more, it's amazing the amount of kit that they could get if they could get people to sell it to them, which I think we absolutely should, because if you let China succeed with this wolf warrior diplomacy that they're pushing so much, they're going to push it more and more, and which is, as they get stronger, continue to get stronger, which we should assume they're going to do for at least another decade and a half or so, it becomes a point of worry. You know, we were talking about Russia before, and Russia still is building off of a lot of legacy and inertia from the Soviet Union. And they do have some great military kit that they've done evolutionary from those designs that they've inherited. And they do spend a larger percentage on their GDP than any other Western industrialized nation, I believe. So they look a lot stronger than they actually are. But I thought, and these are 2018 numbers, but I saw a really good reminder number when you look, and as we've talked about here for over a decade, don't underestimate Russia. However, she's also not 10 feet tall. She's much smaller than that. If you look at 2018 numbers, the Russian economy is worth $1.4 trillion, making it the 12th largest in the world. However, that's the equivalent of the Benelux. If you took the economy of the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg, folded it all together, that would equal the economy of Russia. The West and NATO has the economic strength to keep Russia inside of her box. Relative question is, do we have the institutional political will to act that way? So far, we've seen the British and the Americans doing that, but we really haven't seen our other allies. I mean, I had read before the show, I was looking to see where I could, where it came from. I couldn't find it in time. But I did read a report that other ships could have joined the British and decided not to. And that, I think one of them was the Dutch, one of the Seven Provinces frigates. But the Dutch government demurred, and so the Brits went alone. That would have been shame. It would have been a great air show for everybody if it had been a formation of two or three ships as opposed to just one.
Yeah. But speaking of numbers of ships, we also need to talk about what's going on with the budget and where our 355 ship Navy is going to come from if under the current budget system, and when that will happen, if that ever happens.
Yeah, I don't. Our friend Brian McGrath likes to say, winter is coming. No, winter's here. The 2020s are going to be tough. The Biden administration didn't come in with a mandate to push a big Navy or to grow a big Navy. They have, and I guess we can talk about our nominated Secretary of the Navy coming up here, took their time nominating a Secretary of the Navy and didn't quite pick somebody who is high profile, to say the least. One thing I've bounced off a few people, and I've heard other people say it too, I mean, there's also a psychological thing where a big Navy was seen as a Trump thing, and there's a non-zero percentage of people in the Biden administration who goes, then we don't want that because that's something Trump wanted, and we have to resist what Trump wanted, so we're not going to do that. So we have a little bit of a headwind there. And about the only optimistic thing you can say is when you run out of money is when you got to start thinking. But one of the things that worried me is everybody's talking about China. And in the Navy side, we talk about how we've given up range and we need to do this, that, and the other thing. When you look at where they're putting the money, I guess this is because we just waited so long to do it. Is when you look at their nuclear modernization, that's $27.7 billion. When you look at their missile defense and defeat, which is purely defensive, that's another $20.4 billion. If you're looking for something offensive, which odds are, as is the nature of how America does war, we usually take it on the chin, but then we push back forward. Only thing I can find of any significance is long-range fires investment, a $6.6 billion. And that's nothing that's going to show up in the next 5 years. So, yep, as a nuclear power, we need to have a nuclear deterrence. But when people look at the possible wars that's going to come down the road, it's going to be those long-range fires that we're going to use. We're not going to use our nuclear deterrence, though we need it there. When you look at what the aircraft that we're buying and the ships that we're buying, I mean, we're going to have the ballistic missile submarine and the Virginia-class submarine take the biggest bite out of it with $5 billion and $6.9 billion each. We are going to get – we'll see what Congress does. Congress will probably add another one to this. But at least we get one Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. We'll get one of the new frigates that we love so much, one replenishment ship. And then some, you know, I like the new tugs, of course, another Tagos ship, which is be nice, another aircraft carrier. The large unmanned surface vessel is getting $200 million. I guess that's better than nothing. I wouldn't spend much more than that at this stage of the game anyway, but there's not much going to the Navy, so I guess we need to think about what we want to do when the winds change and eventually more money starts coming Navy way, or maybe Congress will do what they want to do, and those numbers might change a bit, but it's a tough time to be a navalist.
Yeah, I mean, we're wasting so much money on other things. I mean, if you look at the numbers of estimated fraud arising out of the COVID-19 expenditures, I mean, it's not a matter of hundred millions of dollars. It's billions of dollars, and a lot of that is going out of the country. I mean, there are all these this Paycheck Protection Program and the stimulus checks went to dead people and foreign citizens, and I mean, here the Foundation for Economic Education says that we sent $850 million to a Nigerian scammer ring in Washington State, and a rapper stole $1.2 million, and he was arrested after he rapped about it. I mean, those are small, relatively small numbers compared to the amount of money you need to enlarge the fleet. But if you're talking, $63 billion or more numbers in that category, or maybe $200 billion, that will buy you a nice fleet. And we just have kind of thrown it away rather than exert some control over this stuff and put it into positions where we would create jobs, well-paying jobs in shipyards and in fact growing our shipyards, put it into reviving updating our strategic sea lift ships, which ought to make the other Sal happy. You know, those things that need to be done, and they look at infrastructure, and I see roads and highways, that's all great, but infrastructure also includes the bits and pieces we need to make sure that we have the assets we need to get to provide for the defense of the country and to be able to transport ground forces, if required, to places they need to go in order to fight wars. And I'm hopeful that we're not talking about land wars in Asia, because we all know that is something to be not engaged in.
I think that the numbers sometimes can be lost, but you know, especially when you talk about the PPP and the COVID money went to individuals. Just, you know, let me do some quick math here. That would be 87 billion dollars, which is less than the figure that you quoted. For 87 billion, that's what we're going to spend for all of our aircraft and all of our ships that we're buying. You know, those numbers are significant. So they're going to thieves. They're going to criminal organizations as opposed to going to factory floors, shipyards, and things that make good-paying jobs for law-abiding people. I don't know if our Justice Department is going to go after these people. I don't think we'll see any of the money, but that's okay. I would be happy to see people in jail. We need to make an example out of people who have, in the middle of a pandemic, taken advantage of that to steal money borrowed in the name of children yet born. And when we have other things that need to be taken care of, and fraud in government programs is nothing new, but this is kind of a special circumstance, and through their elected representatives, the American people decided to expedite help to people, and those criminals who take advantage of that, what is in essence charity, the full force of the law should be coming down on these people, and sooner more than later, but I haven't seen or read any type of organized effort to go after these people, just people shrugging their shoulders and going, oh, well.
Yeah, I think there's a program somewhere, I can't remember the name of it, but there used to be a program where private citizens could go after fraud, waste, and abuse and get rewarded for cracking down on these things. I mean, to me, it's akin to the letters of mark and reprisal that people are always raising. Well, that's how we can fight the Somali pirates or other things. You know, let's empower all these forensic accountants to get involved in this and reward them for their efforts of getting, you know, at least find out where this money went, and if we can recover any of it, then and get it back. I mean, it was bad enough when you have the Solyndra and other type scandals. My brother did a great series on some fraud that did result in a guy going to jail from some stuff in Wyoming. We're talking hundreds of millions rather than the billions. We need to get those billions back. We need to have tighter controls on where this stuff goes. We need to get all these dead people stop all these dead people and foreign citizens from getting benefits. I don't care how we do it, but, you know, it can't be that our government computers, well, maybe I'm wrong, but it can't be that our government computers are so screwed up that we just willy-nilly send checks out to everybody whose name appears somewhere without knowing whether they're citizens or alive or dead.
Yeah, I think, you know, money is also a great motivator. I don't know how you could legally do this, but I'm very happy with the 10% finder fee. If you are a really detail-oriented forensic accountant and you find $1 billion that had been brought together, or $100 million, use whatever round figure you want to, from a bunch of thieves and a bunch of different accounts, and you're able to tie it together, and the government's able to seize that money and arrest those people, give them $10 million or $100 million, whatever that is. Well, let them go buy that's the jobs program too. He'll go build a house on a lake somewhere. I'm fine with that. If that's what it takes to motivate to get these people, and then put them in jail for a long time. However, you know, when you're dealing with those big numbers, you're dealing with international syndicates, kind of like, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do know human nature. A lot of the problem that we're having with the coyotes and the people smuggling rings coming from Central America and Mexico is that's run by the cartels. Cartels don't negotiate with people that kill them. There's a lot of fear, and they put out a lot of money there. If we're going to start going after those people, you're going to deal with international criminal organizations. They might, when they find out who ratted them out, they might come for their money. So maybe if we can find a way to keep that stuff secret. But that would be something I wish that the Attorney General Garland would invest his personal capital in. Looking for those that are actually doing harm, and that will be a story. What do you think? Before the 2022 election sucks all the oxygen out of the air, and it, maybe by end of the summer, when normalization of COVID starts to level out, maybe that'll start getting some attention from the media and law enforcement. I would hope so, because God, that's a lot of money to put in the pocket of thieves.
Yeah, I just put up a link to the false claim, an explanation of the False Claim Act, which includes bounties under that allows people to come forward if they want to pursue going after people or businesses that defraud the federal government. And according to this site, over $56 billion recovered since the 1986 amendments were passed. So, you know, there is a system out there. We just need to get people involved to go after it and maybe require more bonuses. So, anyway, just an idle thought.
Well, you know, one thing I mentioned in the pre-show announcements and just briefly talked before, while we're talking about money, and I'm not saying this, you know, in our system, money and politics is important. But we did finally get from one of our associate chapters of the realm of the Exalted Order of the Retired O5s, we do have a nominee as Secretary of the Navy, Del Toro, Carlos Del Toro. He's a CEO of a tech solutions company, and you've heard me talk here before with our guests about, you know, what at least I like in a SecNav. I've always thought an effective SecNav needs to be a politician because they know people, they know how to get what they want with people, they know how to trade, they have good people sense. I don't need a technocrat as a Secretary of the Navy. We have legions of them all over the place. Whether you agree with a lot that he did, and I don't, Mavis was successful for his priorities because he was a politician. He had that skill set. It is a skill set. But Del Toro, retired O5, gone into the civilian world. However, my understanding is he's been very active for a long time in Democrat fundraising circles. If so, he's not a politician, but he's politician adjacent. Whatever people he raised money for, I hope they're still in office and they're friends with that. And he's been doing that. He should know how to work a room. Maybe he has political skills. So I'm willing to give Del Toro the benefit of the doubt and wish him best wishes, but he's got to get through the nominating process first, which I think he probably will. But I know a couple people who know of him, but besides the fact that I could sit down at a Cuban restaurant with him and we could talk about our favorite dishes, and he'd like fried yuca with me, and we could discuss whether the flan was produced properly. I don't know anything about the guy, and I don't know people who really do. So I guess we'll discover each other together, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, his background he's got some of the stuff going. Apparently, he was a senior executive assistant to the director for program analysis and evaluation in the OSD, special assistant director and deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget. He got a master's degree in legislative affairs from George Washington University, you know, so at least he's got some experience. It looks like he will know how the political ball, what is played in the political ballpark. And so that's good.
He's political adjacent, and he knows how to get around the metro. So it's, There's a reason for optimism, but he's walking into a hard job. He's going to be the least favorite child in this administration for a variety of reasons. Navy has alienated some of its friends and has reinforced disappointment with those that never liked it to begin with, and especially has given the other services, if not additional clout, has decreased our relative clout to him. So that's an opportunity for him to right the ship and make it for what it is. It's also a significant danger for those that are concerned about the status of our Navy and the future of our Navy, because if he fails or if he's a bad fit, that's just another rock in the backpack of with many rocks that the Navy has put on itself for a while. So I want to be optimistic. I want him to succeed. I want him to do well. I just hope that he doesn't let us down. And again, we'll just have to discover and see. But if we could just get him approved, put his name on his assigned parking space, and get him in his office, that would be great.
Yeah, I'd like to see some stiffer backbones in the senior leadership in the Navy, including I hope from Mr. Del Toro. So you know, at some point when everybody says we need a bigger Navy, including at one point the chief of staff of the Joint Chiefs, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I can't imagine, you know, Admiral Gilday and hopefully Mr. Del Toro not standing up and going, that's right, and we need more money, and we need to take it from the Army or whatever. And you know, let's not fool around with us anymore. We need this for X number of years, and then the Army can get their share that they normally get. But for the 10-year thing, we need to really get these ships moving and the shipyards built and the strategic sea lift rebuilt and solve the problems of the Virginia-class submarines, which have apparently spare parts issues, and or that's causing a problem. And that's a pretty important program for us. I don't think we need to be underfunding things like that. So, you know, this is one of those situations where at some point, if it's got to be serious enough that somebody's willing to say, if we don't get what we need, I'm gonna resign, and you're gonna have to get somebody else while I go screaming into the good night that the reason I'm left is because you know this is woefully underfunding one of the most vital assets we have for this defense of this country. You still there, Sal? Hello? Can anybody hear me? Well, hello?
Should be able to hear me.
Hello? I hear you now.
Hey, folks in the chat room.
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, you can hear me now?
I can hear you, yeah.
Okay, good. Good. I can hear you, so there we go. You know, live radio, that's okay. It's summertime in Florida. I can always blame things on the weather. But yeah, let's pull the thread a little bit on that Virginia class attack submarine parts issue, because I think you know the problem a little better than I do. But what I've been able to glean from it is the parts pipeline is so I'll use my favorite E word, exquisite, that it appears that parts are not lasting as long as they thought, so they need to be replaced there earlier, and there's so little flex in the system, or the supply chain is so fragile that, you know, what was it, USS Boise, that had to wait around 18 months before she could get her shipyard time, that there's so little flex in the system that if everything doesn't work perfectly, what arguably could be our most important asset in the Western Pacific, should we have to go there to break things and kill people, that everything's coming to a halt. You know, what's causing the fragility of that supply chain? How much of it is trying to get the most efficiency possible out of it? Lack of suppliers. You know, what do you see as the malfunction there? And if it's happening there, how close is that happening in other communities, i.e. the service community, where because of culture, it's easier to hide problems than in the submarine community because of their margin for error and because of naval reactors, they don't play around, at least in my experience, when it comes to when it comes to parts and maintenance issues.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems is that the estimates of how long certain parts would last has proved inadequate. And so, as somebody said, I guess the acting secretary of the Navy said, some parts are failing more quickly than we originally envisioned, which means that the only way they've been able to keep some of the ships going is they cannibalize them from other submarines. So, you know, that's never a good thing. And the last time I ever... When if you ever served on a Gearing class destroyer, which I think we got rid of the last ones in maybe in the late 70s or early 80s. Anyway, the only way we kept some of those ships going was because we quit making those parts. You know, so if you needed something that no longer existed, you could only get it from an existing ship, and that's how we kept those things going as long as we could, was cannibalization. But Virginia class are not that old. And, you know, I don't know the only thing you can do is to reassess what parts are wearing out this quickly. And I don't know how their system works to get an assembly line going to make just those parts. But sounds like this is something of great importance, and I assume that the sub-manufacturers, the people who make that equipment, are working overtime to get that stuff resolved, because this is a ludicrous problem to have. Given the importance of our submarine forces, is acutely damaging to our national defense.
Yeah, it'd be curious to see why they're wearing out earlier. Is it because we're using them more? Because we've all seen situations, especially if you're having to rob parts, that a part is designed to be used for X length of time, you know, at maximum use for, you know, Y number of days. However, if instead of it having, quote, downtime or not being used constantly, it's being taken off of unit one to go on to unit two, so it's being used up twice as fast, or is this a material condition thing, i.e. the materials are not as robust as they thought they were, which would be interesting because it's not like we're new at building submarines. We could have worse problems, like I dug around a little bit, the latest Russian monster to hit their fleet that you saw a lot of people write about is their new special ops submarine, the modified Oscar II class of the Belgorod. That, I mean, it's a big girl. I mean, at 184 meters. But what was interesting is that submarine was started in 1992, and they restarted it in I think like year 2000. Working on it. So here we are at 2021. It's finally getting commissioned. The Virginia class, I just made a couple of notes. How big is the Virginia class? I think the Virginia class is, I don't have that. But I do know the equivalent of the Belgorod is our Seawolf class submarine, the Jimmy Carter. It's 138 meters long, much smaller. Heck, an Ohio class ballistic missile submarine is 170 meters, and the Hunt for Red October Memorial Typhoon class is 175 meters. So it's 9 meters longer than even a Typhoon. Big girl, but she's only one. She's one ship. Oh, Virginia class is 115 meters long. The latest Russian.
Yeah, we have 48 Virginia class subs.
Yeah, they've got one Belgorod, and we have one Jimmy Carter too. And they just commissioned their latest submarine, the Janssen. It's 139 meters, and Virginia is not a small boat either. So the Russians are producing big ones, but not that many. I guess each one of their submarines is almost going to be like a custom job. But when you have 40 of a class of submarine, you think you'd have some type of parts inventory that you wouldn't run into this type of bottleneck. But yeah, I hope, you know, if he gets through the nomination process, Del Toro, I hope that's on his top five list, because I don't know any serious person who does not believe that our Virginia class submarines are going to be the first thing that goes west in volume. What do you do when you say, yeah, we've got 40 submarines, but of the 40, only 28 can deploy right now. And of the 28 that can deploy, 18 of them are fully mission capable due to parts. And of those, 30% are in the Atlantic. You know, your math gets really different really fast. So, yeah, we need to solve that parts problem.
Yeah, apparently it's in the early blocks, you know, according to this, the engineering analysis and testing indicates the parts on the submarines that first entered the service in 2004 were supposed to last for several decades, but unexpected degradation like corrosion caused by complex galvanic interactions has caused some of the parts to wear down sooner than they thought they would. Anyway, the first two blocks of submarines have the problem.
PMS.
Yeah, well, who knows? I don't think that's usually a problem on the nuke boats, but...
When were we supposed to put in that little sacrificial piece of zinc? Oh, we were supposed to replace that 5 years ago. Oh, Oh, okay. Well, let's replace that now and just not tell anybody. Yeah, that doesn't go over real well. I'm not saying that's what happened. It's just what I think we've all seen similar things happen at other locations. But, yeah, at least it's getting the attention it needs. But that takes money. That takes time. And then you have to say, okay, if we're having it with these parts, do we have it with other parts? And we're going to have all these ships last a longer time. And the older a ship is, the higher the maintenance costs are. And as we've had guests talk on before, and this is a danger we can fall into quickly again, is when all we're doing is focusing on ship numbers. How many holes do we have displacing water? How many aircraft do we have making a shadow on a ramp? Are we planning for and properly funding the maintenance and support system to go with it? So if we have things displacing water, there are things that can actually deploy and send ordnance downrange. Planes that can actually take off and do their mission as opposed to take off and land and nothing else. We have shortchanged that maintenance support and parts issue before, and in a tightening budget environment when people are trying to scrape together as many holes as they want to, I am worried that we're not going to continue at least the talking about getting better maintenance and support. I'd always would much rather have 8 units that are well-maintained than 10 units that are less well-maintained, but 10 units looks better on a PowerPoint than 8 units, so I still have a concern there.
Yeah, but we go back to the classic problem. You know, we want a 355 ship Navy, or maybe 321 ships or something. But one way that we're going to go about that is by decommissioning ships. I mean, this we're looking at decommissioning the 7 guided missile cruisers, and Lord knows they are long in the tooth, but. I hope that the people are paying attention. We've got some really good young Congress people, and Representative Gloria and the other folks that are up there that know
Mike
about
Gallagher.
The Navy. And I think Mike Gallagher, Secretary of the Navy, now is going to be a former CEO of a destroyer or DDG. So, they're going to know about these problems and understand that we can't. Perhaps a new DDG is the equivalent of the old cruisers, but you need those missile tubes, and unless we come up with some kind of towed missile tube system akin to those in science fiction, we're going to be short tubes and unless we get this shipbuilding stuff done much faster than we're doing it. And I cannot believe we can afford to retire the 7 cruisers and the tubes that they currently have.
Yeah, they're well-loved and well-used ships, and this is big Navy's fault. They should have had a more realistic idea of what they wanted to do with CGX, but they were plagued by a flood of good idea fairies and people that don't understand money, and so that blew up in their face. And we're gonna, it's like the old joke we've all heard, especially after they did the restart of the Arleigh Burkes. Is we're just going to build Arleigh Burkes till the crack of doom. We are, because we don't even need to replace it. And the large service combatant, I'm afraid they're overthinking it. And it should not, and it doesn't have to, this is all conscious decisions, take this long to get a class of warships put together, unless you insist that you have the perfect solution, one ship that'll do it all. We've talked in the past about one of my favorite periods of warship development, 1920s and the 1930s. They had multiple classes that built off of each other. They learned as they went, and they got stuff underway. Same thing with battleships, same things with aircraft carriers. Whereas we seem to want to, like we have with the Arleigh Burke, a ship designed in the 1990s that we're going to have at this rate till the last quarter of the 21st century underway, that might be slightly efficient if you want to run it, but it's not very effective and it doesn't give you an opportunity to learn. And that's, we should have quite a few new cruisers already displacing water, but we haven't because we blew up CGX and we didn't respond appropriately. And a lot of that has to do with our acquisitions process, which needs to be fixed and changed. I think a lot of that, though, has to do with the mindset of the people who are in charge of shipbuilding. They have forgotten what the generations before have done because we've been doing this for two decades. They don't know anything else. Longer than two decades. You can make it three decades.
Yeah, I think that it's so much easier to when you're in an office and you think, okay, we're gonna dramatically fix all the problems in the Navy with a ship that won't be available for 10 years, and then you're going to leave whatever job you have, and somebody else is going to get stuck with the problem that you didn't really solve by planning ahead. And I thought Representative Luria exactly nailed that when she was talking to the CNO at the hearings on this. She said, what are you doing trying to inactivate 15 ships when we know you're looking at the future, but how is that going to help us with the current issues? And she said, this is the quote, "I understand you were given a pretty shitty top line by the administration, specifically the Pentagon. You didn't have a lot of good choices, but you did have choices. And so I was looking at the words you used, and you said this budget is going to divest to invest." Now, where have we heard that before? And so that's your strategy you're using. And I looked back over the last 20 years of budgets and saw that was a very familiar term, especially in 2004 budget when the Navy used that same divest to invest strategy. You know, we've got to stop thinking that way. You've got to, the Russians, I don't know if they're still flying the B-29 things they used to fly, but they never threw anything away. And sometimes, I don't know what it's going to take to keep those cruisers going. I don't know how badly dinged up they are at this point, but, if you could buy another 5 years with them, that would give you those tubes for 5 years. And I don't care if you have to park the damn things at Guam and have them set us alongside the pier or anchored off Mog or one of those other Pacific islands in the Marianas. At least you've got the tubes available somewhere.
Yeah, and a lot of it is we haven't been real honest with ourselves about material conditions and what we can actually do. It's funny that she mentioned 2004. That's when you may have actually been in 2003, but that's when you and I started blogging. That was at the very dawn of blogging. So not only do we remember this, we wrote through this. We've seen this story before. We've seen this play before. It sounds really good for one or two PCS cycles until all of a sudden somebody has to actually start cutting steel or and aluminum, and putting things together that don't work. And then it is somebody else's problem. And all those people that made those decisions in 03, 04, 05, we know when they retired, and we know the jobs they took afterwards. And we know people who were fired and professionally humiliated years later trying to fix the problems that other people created but never assumed responsibility for. And it's very easy when things are real hard to say, well, we're just going to divest to invest, so I want to spend all this money for stuff that won't show up for 10 or 15 years. Well, okay, then what type of fleet are you going to ask sailors to go to war with in 2026? What does that look like? How long can you sustain that? That's the question they don't want to answer in a hearing. And because they did have the answer, it should rightfully scare the living hell out of everybody. but I think it's, I can understand why, if you think that we control the future, that we will determine when we go to war, and when we go to war, we'll go to war on our terms and our timeline. But good googly moogly, that's a hell of a lot of arrogance to put out there in the history of the world. You've got to be prepared. Yes, you have to plan for the war tomorrow, but you better be ready for the war that could come in 6, 12, or 24 months. If you don't, that it's more likely that war is going to show up. And when it does, there you go.
Well, you know, if it were me, if I were running some of this stuff, you know, I would look serious at our amphib fleet. I don't know if we're still building some of those ships. I mean, I don't mind the big deck amphibs, the ones that can carry F-35s and stuff, but we really need to take a hard look at what we need for amphibious capability. I hate pouring money into that rat hole personally, and I view it as a rat hole, which says a lot about my experience with amphibs.
They do have a certain musk about them. Hey, I think I just realized what time it is. You know, that's funny for the listeners. Whenever we have a free for all, so I'm just like, what are we going to talk about? It's like, oh, we'll figure it out when we get there. We never have a problem talking for an hour. I will admit that I'm more interested in this than I really want to admit. And I was prepared to be disappointed, and I was. 25 June 2021 is when the preliminary assessment for unidentified aerial phenomena was put out. One thing I will say about it is a lot of us have seen interesting things at sea, but they did put some fun stuff out there that'll keep the conspiracy people's plates twirling. 144 reports originated from U.S. government sources. Of these, 80 reports involved observations with multiple sensors. And I guess the executive summary for this report is, yes, there's something out there. We have no idea what it is, which is really the most realistic way to describe it. I would also, a lot of people a lot of people making note about these grainy videos coming off of the F-18s. A lot of the military video that you see is grainy like that. That's not what the pilots are seeing. Usually what happens, depending upon the airframe, it has to go through two cycles of transfer from digital to analog, analog to digital, and then onto something that could be put online. Every time you do that, you lose fidelity and bytes of data. So the image that the pilots or the operators on the ships see is much clearer than what the general public is seeing. So I've had to tell a couple people about it, like, who were suspicious about, well, they say they saw that, but I've seen the video, and it's like, no, 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 no. Squint your eyes and look at a newspaper. That's the difference. They are seeing something much clearer than that on their equipment. But I don't know. I just thought it was nice that the report came out, but I don't think it's going to make anybody really happy.
Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation I had with my dad when he was flying with the Air Force, and I was very interested in UFOs and stuff. I think probably the original The Day the Earth Stood Still with Michael Rennie, and that might have been Patricia Neal, actually. Anyway, came out. You know, we were flying saucers, all that stuff, and I asked him, I said, did you ever see anything that you couldn't identify out there? He goes, yes. And I said, well, what were they? He says, we don't know. They were unidentified. pretty much sums it up.
Well, and that's all you can really say. It's a big world out there, and I always try to maintain very humble nature, because until a few hundred years ago, nobody had any idea about airplanes. Had a little bit of the idea of a rocket, if you thought about it, but flying and going faster than the speed of sound, we're always discovering new things about physics. If ever want to get myself really confused, I'll start reading about quantum physics. There's some stuff out there in the physics and mathematical world that we just don't understand. And there, but the minute somebody does understand it, then these things that people don't know what they are, they'll understand them. And it might be, you know, something that is much less sexier than people wish it was. But by math or by pure accident, I think some of these things will eventually be understood. But the one good thing about it is people aren't crazy. Well, some people are crazy. Not everybody is crazy. Not everybody is making stuff up. Not everybody is, you know, being whatever you want to call it. There's some stuff out there that we just don't know what it is. Doesn't mean it's little green men. It doesn't mean it's time travel, but it's something. So if somebody says they saw something they can't explain, they might have, or they might be a nut, but they might have.
You know, there are more things. What's the thing from Schaefer? More things in heaven and earth than something. So, yeah, we'll never know. I mean, at some point we'll know, but not today.
I noticed earlier. I mean, we have a pretty good chat room today with Paul and Claude. We got the right Cal, the other Sal. We got Stephen. Nobody told us we were idiots today. So I guess it must be a pretty good show. But being that we do have a lot of the usual suspects in the chat room, I want to just for those that are with us live, especially for those who catch the podcast, I hope everybody has a great July 4th weekend. Post-COVID July 4th, the beaches will be busy. And if the rest of the nation has been like where I live for the last 9 months, you'll be able to actually act like a human being again, which is nice.
Yeah, I hope everybody has a great 4th. I'm planning to even set off some fireworks, which I discovered one of my kids had left. They're probably now 20 years old, but I assume they'll still go off. So I better wear eye protection now.
If not, you'll have a fun time trying. So, yep. Thanks. Thanks again for a great hour, everybody. And until next time, hope y'all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.